Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 995, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This is being recorded on February 6th of the year 2018. Well, as the title of the program very obviously indicates, we are going to be bringing up to date a number of stories and topics we have covered either in recent programs or in the case of eugenics and euthanasia for many years, going back several decades. We're going to be taking a look at one of the more virulent and potentially lethal outcroppings of the leaderless resistance strategy, and bringing up to date in that same context the Atomwaffen division. That is for the most part, apparently a youthful Nazi organization. The name in German means atomic weapon or weapons. And we're going to be taking a look at their dovetailing with advocates of not only the leaderless resistance strategy, but also the persistent Charles Manson cult, something that, as we will see, overlaps the leaderless resistance strategy, and some of its advocates, like an American Nazi named James Mason. In some of our discussions of Glenn Greenwald, who became something of a political folk hero in connection with the Raphael Snowden, I have noted his past as an attorney who ran legal interference for the leaderless resistance strategy, and in particular for the National Alliance, whose publications are specifically intended as how-to manuals and or motivational manuals to spur their followers to acts of racist violence and mayhem. Defenders of Greenwald's activities in that regard and apologists for his activities in that regard have very mistakenly characterized that as being at one with the ACLU's defense of American Nazis who staged a march in Skokie, Illinois, some decades ago. There were a number, perhaps still are, a number of Holocaust survivors in Skokie, which is specifically why the Nazis wanted to stage their march. They were defended in their right to do so by the American Civil Liberties Union. That is a fundamentally different consideration from what Greenwald did vis-a-vis the National Alliance. And also another of his Nazi clients, a guy named Matthew Hale. What the ACLU was doing was defending the right to free speech by the Nazis. As far as I know, they were not advocating killing Jews, although obviously the history of the National Socialist or Nazi movement is inextricably linked with that. This was a case of a group expressing a political philosophy or will that was deemed distasteful by many people. What Greenwald was doing was very, very different. What Greenwald did was to defend advocates of and exponents of racial violence and mayhem against civil liability for their actions. This was not, as Greenwald said mistakenly, I suspect not accidentally, the criminalization of free speech. This was the civil liability of someone who has advocated violence to being sued by a victim of the violence so advocated. This had nothing to do with criminalization of free speech. advocates of that sort of thing are free still, or were free still, to advocate that sort of thing, basically killing or harming, you name it, Jews, gays, blacks, whoever. However, if it could be reasonably demonstrated that their actions had led directly, or that advocacy had led directly to the harming of individuals or the killing of individuals, then those advocates bore civil responsibility or liability for that. They could be sued and assessed damages for that behavior. This was a civil, not a criminal, consideration. Very, very different indeed. We are going to be delving back into the Atomwaffen in, for the record, 967. We took a look at this group. A couple of them had been shot to death by a former roommate, and former comrade in arms, so to speak, of them. And another roommate and associate of Atomwaffen, a Florida National Guardsman named Brandon Russell, R-U-S-S-E-L-L, was arrested and found to contain radioactive material, bomb-making material, and was, according to associates, planning an attack on a Florida nuclear power plant. With the sort of technology that is available today, even a relatively small number of lone wolf terrorists or malefactors can wreak a tremendous amount of havoc. I would note that as we looked at in, for the record, 967, a defender of and apparent associate of the Atomwaffen, the brilliant Nazi hacker Andrew Auernheimer, a.k.a. Weave, the web architect for the Daily Stormer, was an associate of them and defended them as a bunch of good dudes who liked to party. Auernheimer is resident in Ukraine. His name crops up in connection with searches for hacked Hillary Clinton emails in the 2016 campaign. What I would note is that someone with the consummate hacking skills of an Andrew Auernheimer and with the weakification of society could wreak untold havoc on the society, a society that was targeted, bringing down a nuclear power plant or two or three, or sabotaging the electrical grid or what have you. In addition, as we are going to see, not only are the Atomwaffen influenced by an advocate of lone wolf slash leaderless resistance strategy named James Mason, who published a newsletter called Siege that was later bound into a single volume. But Mason and the Atomwaffen also revered Charles Manson, the late mass murderer who finally expired after spending much of the recent decades in San Quentin, or really pretty much since his conviction in the very early 1970s for the Tate LaBianca killings in L.A. In 1969. Manson has become something of a cult hero to advocates of extreme culture as well as Nazis and Satanists per se. And that is something that I think augurs very poorly indeed. If people who are young, still immature, perhaps dabbling in substance abuse and not wrapped too tight, fall into a Manson cult mentality and are influenced by the kinds of activities that he did, that could add a particular category of potential recruits to the leaderless resistance strategy advocated by James Mason. and to an extent apparently put into practice by the Atomwaffen. I would note that, as we have looked at in past programs, including a for-the-record program called Manson Family Values, the Manson killings appear to have, an extent, not only provided fodder for anti-black propaganda. The Tate-LaBianca killings were represented by as the work of the Black Panthers, but Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski, the former of whom was one of the victims of the Tate, obviously, and LaBianca killings, were two of the main organizers of Robert Kennedy's campaign in Los Angeles. And about an evening or two before Robert Kennedy was assassinated, he had reiterated something he had mentioned before, which was that when he was elected president, as he figured to be in 1968, had he not been assassinated, he was going to reopen the investigation into his brother's murder. That is discussed in, among other books, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters by James Douglas. A good introductory book about the JFK assassination for someone just approaching that subject. So, of the Atomwaffen, who have now been connected to a number of other murders, apparently, we begin by taking a look at an article from ProPublica from January 26th of 2018. This is by A.C. Thompson, Ali Winston, and Jake Hanrahan, H-A-N-R-A-H-A-N. California murder suspect said to have trained with extremist hate group. Now, this refers to the murder of a Jewish and openly gay University of Pennsylvania student named Blaze, B-L-A-Z-E, Bernstein, B-E-R-N-S-T-E-I-N. The man accused of that is a guy named Samuel Woodward, W-O-O-D-W-A-R-B, skipping down. The man, Samuel Woodward, has been charged in Orange County, California, with murdering Blaze Bernstein, who went missing in early January while visiting his family over winter break. Prosecutors allege that Woodward stabbed Bernstein more than 20 times before burying his body in an Orange County park where it was eventually discovered. The two men had attended high school together. Skipping down. Now, three people with detailed knowledge of Woodward's recent past have been able to shed more light on the young man's extremist activities. They said Woodward was a member of the Atomwaffen Division, an armed fascist group with the ultimate aim of overthrowing the U.S. government through the use of terrorism and guerrilla warfare. The organization, which celebrates Hitler and Charles Manson, has been tied to four other murders and an elaborate bomb plot over the past 8 months. Experts who study right-wing extremist movements believe Atomwaffen's commitment to violence has made it one of the more dangerous groups to emerge from the new wave of white supremacists. Two of the three people who describe Woodward's affiliations are friends of his. The other is a former member of Atomwaffen Division. Skipping down. Woodward joined the organization in early 2016 and later traveled to Texas to attend Atomwaffen meetings and a three-day training camp which involved instruction in firearms, hand-to-hand combat, camping, and survival skills, the former member of the group said. ProPublica has obtained photographs of Woodward at an outdoor Atomwaffen meeting in the scrubby Texas countryside. One of the photos depicts Woodward and other members making straight-armed Nazi salutes while wearing skull masks. In other pictures, Woodward is unmasked and easily identifiable. Woodward is proficient with both handguns and assault rifles, according to one person who participated in the Texas training and watched him shoot. That person also said that Woodward helped organize a member of Atomwaffen members That person also said that Woodward helped organize a number of Afro-Moroccan members in California. Social media posts and chat logs shared by Woodward's friends show that he openly described himself as a national socialist, unquote, or Nazi. He, quote, was as anti-Semitic as you can get, unquote, according to one acquaintance.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Skipping down again, reviewing some of what happened with Afanwaffen and also their affiliation with James Mason and some of his professional pedigree. Afanwaffen started in 2015 and is estimated to have some 80 members scattered around the country in small cells. The former member said the group's ranks had grown since the lethal and chaotic Unite the Right rally last summer in Charlottesville, Virginia. While many of the new white extremist groups have consciously avoided using Nazi imagery, Afanwaffen has done the opposite. The name can mean atomic weapons in German, and the organization embraces Third Reich iconography, including swastikas, the Totenkopf or Death's Head insignia, and SS lightning bolts. The group frequently produces YouTube videos featuring masked Afanwaffen members hiking through the backcountry and firing weapons. They've also filmed themselves burning the U.S. Constitution and setting fire to the American flag at an Afanwaffen doomsday hate camp, unquote. Afanwaffen's biggest inspiration seems to be James Mason, a longtime fascist who belonged to the American Nazi Party and later during the 1970s joined a more militant offshoot. During the 1980s, Mason published a newsletter called Siege, in which he eschewed political activism in favor of creating a new fascist regime through murder, small lone wolf terror attacks, and all-out war against the government. Mason also struck up a friendship with the late Charles Manson, who has become another hero for Afanwaffen. And skipping down and reviewing some of the information about the murder of a couple of Afanwaffen members and the arrest of a fourth. When law enforcement searched the apartment in Tampa, Florida, where Archer's and the others, A-R-T-H-U-R-S, and the others lived, they found firearms, a framed photograph of Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh, rifles, ammunition, and a cooler full of a highly volatile explosive called HMTD. Investigators also discovered radioactive material in the home. The bomb-making material belonged to a fourth roommate, Afanwaffen leader Brandon Russell, a Florida National Guardsman. Archers told authorities that Russell had been planning to blow up a nuclear power plant near Miami. Earlier this month, Russell pleaded guilty in federal district court in Tampa to illegal possession of explosives and was sentenced to 5 years in federal prison. Afanwaffen surfaced again in connection with a double homicide in Reston, Virginia, in December of 2017. A 17-year-old neo-Nazi allegedly shot to death his girlfriend's parents, Buckley Kuhn, K-U-H-N, hyphen Fricker, F-R-I-C-K-E-R, and Scott Fricker, who had urged their daughter to break up with him. The accused, who shot himself as well but survived and remains hospitalized, was charged as a juvenile in state court in Virginia with two counts of homicide. The 17-year-old was a big fan of Afanwaffen and James Mason, according to reporting by the Huffington Post, which examined his social media trail. The former Afanwaffen member in contact with ProPublica said that the teen was more than a fan. he was in direct communication with the group. "Their rhetoric is some of the most extreme we have seen," said James Mendelson, a senior researcher at the Anti-Defamation League's Center on Extremism. The group, she said, views itself as the radical vanguard of the white supremacist movement, the frontline soldiers of an imminent race war. While many of the new white extremist groups have consciously avoided using Nazi imagery, Adam Waffen has done the opposite. The name can mean atomic weapons in German, and the organization embraces Third Reich iconography, including swastikas. Again, I'm repeating a section of this I have read earlier. The group, this is one of the most important aspects of this, the group frequently produces YouTube videos featuring masked Atom Waffen members hiking through the backcountry and firing weapons. They've also filmed themselves burning the U.S. Constitution and setting fire to the American flag at an Atom Waffen Doomsday hate camp. The point here being that in addition to what they are actually doing, they are producing YouTube videos that advocate exactly this sort of thing. And that is something that, well, that is something that ultimately is going to be, well, that is going to, I suspect, bear some unsavory fruit in the not-too-distant future. Again, with this country basically going to hell in a handbasket, and with a lot of people out there, young people who are have grown up with social media, with mobile technology, and who perhaps are not wrapped too tight, and indeed the human brain is still developing until the age of 30. The marketability of YouTube videos by groups like Atom Waffen should not be underestimated. And remember, too, that the real evil of what Glenn Greenwald did, and the guy's basically a Nazi lawyer for all practical purposes, was to defend the right to such advocacy against civil liability. It is not, as Greenwald mistakenly stated, the criminalization of free speech. Rather, it is the holding to civil account of those who have produced such material, if in fact their material can be reasonably demonstrated to have motivated people to commit violence and mayhem. It is very, very different than the Skokie situation and the ACLU's defense of the American Nazi Party. And, well, this is Citizen Greenwald, everybody's wonderful creature. I would note, too, that when Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald had a party to celebrate their reception of the prestigious Polk Award, the aforementioned brilliant Nazi hacker Andrew Auernheimer was present and an attendee at that party.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
I'm going to read an article that was alluded to in the ProPublica article. This also was about Adam Waffen and develops the Manson James, the Manson Mason Adam Waffen connection further. I would stress, however, that I find the tone and some of the adjectives used here to be somewhat counterproductive, because there is no shortage of pejorative characterizations of these people. I think their views and their activities speak for themselves. But by calling them, you know, crazies or wackos or beasts or something along those lines, I think that the prose used in this article are misleading. Adolf Hitler wasn't crazy. He was a Nazi. And these people as distasteful as what they advocate and believe may be. They're not crazy, they're not scum, and I think using that sort of off-putting modifiers really obscures the real importance of what they are all about. So with that caveat, I'm going to read some sections of this article from the Huffington Post of November 21st of 2017. The Maniac Neo-Nazis Keeping Charles Manson's Race War Alive by Luke O'Brien and Christopher Mathias. Charles Manson is dead now, and we are the richer for it. Manson was a thief, a pimp, and a murderous cult leader bent on race war. He was true scum. No wonder some alt-righters are pouring out drinks for him. A great revolutionary, said one commentator of Manson on the Iron March neo-Nazi internet forum. The world really does feel a little emptier, said another. One bereaved bigot simply posted a Celine Dion lyric, "Near, far, wherever you are, I believe that the heart does go on." Hero, champion, warrior of truth, such were the tributes used Monday to describe a demented butcher. If you're wondering who might rhapsodize a psychotic racist in this manner, the answer is other psychotic racists, many of whom belong to Abendwaffen Division, a particularly bloodthirsty and anti-American branch of the so-called alt-right that has made worshiping Manson a part of their cultish devotion to violent insurrection. Even within the alt-right, a loose association of white supremacists and fascists, the Abendwaffen Division is considered extreme. The group, whose name translates to Atomic Weapons Division, puts out ISIS-style propaganda videos on YouTube that feature members clad in skull masks and camouflage outfits, sometimes on training exercises in the woods, often holding guns, and the organization's distinctive yellow and black nuclear-themed flags. In one video, members burn a copy of the U.S. Constitution on a grill. One more time, because again, I think this is one of the most important aspects of what they do, and it really places in context the gravity of what Glenn Greenwald did by protecting this sort of thing. Again, not criminalizing free speech, but by protecting them against possible civil liability for having inspired people to do these kinds of things. Defended them against litigation by the victims of these kinds of actions. The group, whose name translates to Atomic Weapons Division, puts out ISIS-style propaganda videos on YouTube that feature members clad in skull masks and camouflage outfits, sometimes on training exercises in the woods, often holding guns, and the organization's distinctive yellow and black nuclear-themed flags. In one video, members burn a copy of the U.S. Constitution. Skipping down. Apocalyptic lunacy has always been part of far-right politics, and the vigorous strain of it runs through today's alt-right white supremacist movement. It should come as no surprise, then, that Manson, whose once-upon-a-time status as a long hair could never obscure the swastika carved into his forehead, might serve as a new vessel of madness for today's violent racists. In many ways, he was a forebearer of groups like Abendwaffen and a bug-eyed prototype for the modern race warrior. Manson's deranged political teachings were a mishmash of Scientology, occultism, and Nazism, all bundled into an original end-of-days tale. "Stay with me," he told his followers, and you will be saved from the coming race war. Manson was motivated by an apocalyptic belief in the imminent end of the world through a race war in which the white population was doomed to defeat. Jeffrey Kaplan wrote in Encyclopedia of White Power, a source book on the radical racist right. The victorious black population would in time realize that the white man is genetically more fit to govern and would seek in vain for white survivors of the racial Holocaust to assume the reins of power. The Manson family, having survived the apocalypse by hiding in the timeless cave at the center of the world, would then emerge to take power, unquote. This worldview led Manson and his followers into an especially desolate part of Death Valley called Barker Ranch in 1969, where Time magazine described them as, quote, holed up in rundown cabins, leading an indolent, almost savage existence, singing Manson songs, dancing, swimming in a small pool, stealing cars for cash, and picking through garbage for food. Here, they would dodge the apocalypse. Of course, eventually Manson was convicted of the Tate LaBianca killings, skipping down, and I've noted that there was a profound political dimension to that. Again, the For the Record show, Manson Family Values, goes into that. It was in prison that Manson started a correspondence with a longtime American neo-Nazi named James Mason, who would come to view Charlie, unquote, as a prophet of hate. Mason was the type of man who considered Auschwitz, quote, a damned nice place, unquote, and his wingnut journey would take him from the heart of an organized white supremacy to years of inept obscurity and ultimately back to a faint relevance in the Trump era thanks to the alt-right and Abermoffen. A fascist since he was 13 when he joined the youth movement of George Lincoln Rockwell's American Nazi Party, Mason had radicalized himself while watching black people take to the streets during the civil rights era. As a young adult, he set up Nazi booths at county fairs in southern Ohio where he'd grown up. We should shoot for bringing down the system, he would later say. Destroy the system, unquote. Mason eventually left the American Nazi Party and joined a splinter group called the National Socialist Liberation Front. Some NSLF members were fans of Manson, which prompted Mason to begin researching the cult leader. In 1980, Mason reached out to the incarcerated Charles Manson. The two began communicating regularly by mail and phone. What I discovered was a revelation equal to the revelation I received when I first found Adolf Hitler, Mason would later explain. Through Charlie, Mason came to understand that Hitler's death had brought about the end of Western civilization. Every government in the world was now part of an anti-white global conspiracy run by super-capitalists, unquote, and super-communists, unquote. Nothing about Western culture or its institutions could be salvaged. It would all have to be blown to smithereens. It's just like a human organism that has ingested a fatal dose of poison, Mason would explain. If you fall asleep with it and try to ride it out, you're going to die. But if you become suddenly, violently ill and expel that poison, even though the experience may be rather unpleasant, you at least have a chance to live. Manson called that helter skelter. So inspired by Charlie was Mason that he took the murderous cult leader's advice and renamed his neo-Nazi organization Universal Order. Mason began writing a newsletter called Seed to promote Manson's views as a continuation of Hitler's philosophy. In 1992, Mason would collect these writings into a book that neo-Nazi skinhead leader Tom Metzger called 435 Pages of Hot Revolutionary-Style White Propaganda, unquote. For Mason and other white supremacists, Manson was almost a divine being, an atavistic incarnation of hate. The cult leader fit neatly into a strain of fascist magical realism called esoteric Hitlerism that became popular after World War II when the Greek writer Savitri Devi proposed that Hitler was the ninth avatar of Vishnu, and racist dupes somehow bought into it. This type of crazy remains en vogue among the alt-right today, with notable exponents such as Andrew Weave Arenheimer, a neo-Nazi hacker and the webmaster for the Daily Stormer, whose charismatic ravings make him the closest thing to a contemporary Manson in the movement. Arenheimer has ties to Adam Waffen, and after the Archer's murders, issued an overloud declamation about how he knew the shooter and the victims, but had previously banned Archers, who basically converted to Islam, as we have seen in 967, from a Daily Stormer forum. But the effects of Charles Manson on today's white supremacist movement, in no small part thanks to Mason's efforts, go beyond evil juju. Consider white separatism in the modern context. Organized racists in America these days like to call themselves white nationalists, unquote. This, of course, is partly a public relations gambit. White nationalist is maybe more palatable than neo-Nazi or white supremacist, unquote. But it is also an accurate description of what they want. Groups across the racist political spectrum want a white nation, an ethno-state, somewhere in America for just the white race. The three-piece suit-wearing figurehead of the alt-right, Richard Spencer, is very open about this. So is veteran skinhead Jeff Shep, SHOEP, the leader of the National Socialist Movement, as is KKK enthusiast Brad Griffin, a.k.a. Hunter Wallace, a leader of the League of the South. Skipping down. Mason's adulation of Manson made him somewhat of an outlier in the American neo-Nazi scene of the 1980s, and Manson veneration remains a prickly subject for current white nationalists. On Stormfront, another neo-Nazi forum, the commentary Monday about Manson's passing mostly had a good riddance and thank God he's dead tenor. The Manson family killed white people after all, and Manson's degeneracy reflects poorly on white supremacy. But degeneracy has never prevented neo-Nazis from attracting supporters. For years, Manson's Charlie-inspired insights were sought after by prominent racists, including Metzger, who interviewed Mason for over an hour in 1993 for his Race and Reason show. When talk turned to violence, as it often does with far-right extremists, Mason clucked disapprovingly about a 1984 mass shooting in which a white survivalist gunman took out his rage at international bankers, unquote, by massacring 21 people at a McDonald's in San Ysidro, California. Quote, it wouldn't be such a bad thing if they would pick their targets a little more carefully, he said. Mason faded into relative obscurity for the rest of the 90s and early aughts, when he was in and out of prison on weapons charges and for an inappropriate relationship with a 14-year-old girl of whom he had taken nude photographs. But in 2017, the year his hero Charlie would pass into the astral plane, Mason has found new relevance and a fawning group of disciples in Adam Waffen. Earlier this year, Adam Waffen republished Mason's book Siege online and announced the launch of a new Universal Order website. James Mason is back, read the July headline on the fascist zine Noose, an Adam Waffen site. After years of trying, the article said, Adam Waffen members had finally tracked down Mason for an exclusive interview. And skipping down. When asked for his thoughts on Anders Breivik, the far-right Norwegian terrorist convicted of killing 77 people in a bombing and mass shooting in 2011, Mason replied that Breivik was, quote, dead on, unquote. I'm never going to disown anybody who does something like that, Mason said. Elsewhere in the interview, Mason said he is mildly encouraged by the rise of Donald Trump. As recently as Sunday, one day before Manson died, Mason apparently wrote an article on the Universal Order website, a 1,400-word treatise praising Nazi eugenics and euthanasia. We have spoken about eugenics and euthanasia and the T4 or Axion T4, the Tiergarten Strasse 4 program in many shows. Most recently, I believe, for the record, 909, maybe been 908. When you see people like Mason advocating Nazi eugenics and euthanasia, one should be aware that they are endorsing a philosophy and practice that was very much part and parcel to some very prestigious intellectual thinkers in the early 20th and 20th century and on through to this date. We've spoken about the eugenics movement and its influence on the Nazi euthanasia practice, which in turn helped train the killers for and set the legal basis for the Nazi extermination programs. And in that context, a couple of articles from The Guardian of January 11th of 2018. UCL to investigate eugenics conference secretly held on campus by Kevin Rawlinson and Richard Adams. And briefly, University College London has launched an urgent investigation into how a senior academic was able to secretly hold conferences on eugenics and intelligence with notorious speakers, including white supremacists. The London Conference on Intelligence was said to have been run secretly for at least 3 years by James Thompson, an honorary senior lecturer at the university, including contributions from a researcher who has previously advocated child rape. One prominent attendee at the conference in May last year was Toby Young, the head of the government-backed New Schools Network, who ran into controversy over efforts to appoint him as a university regulator. There is discussion of the various attendees at the conference. Suffice it to say that the attendees are in many ways participants in the quote alt-right movement, but they also have profound connections to individuals and institutions not generally identified with the alt-right movement. Books like the Bell Curve, organizations like the Pioneer Fund, people connected to some of the eugenicists who helped to influence Josef Mengele, the Angel of Death of Auschwitz, were present at these conferences. There are a couple of articles about these conferences on the written description for this program. They will become available within a few days of the recording of this program. Note that in discussion of Mason and Manson, there was reference to esoteric Nazism. That is something that the Hare Krishna cult overlaps, and in our discussions of Hindutva fascism, that is something that is, as we saw in For the Record 992, that overlaps esoteric Nazism. Telescoping things for the purposes of time, by way of understanding not only the eugenics movement and the T4 program, but how this dovetails with the current Republican attempts at cutting back the social net. There was an op-ed column in the New York Times of September 13th of 2017. It's by Kenny Fries, F-R-I-E-S, the Nazis' first victims were the disabled. I sit facing the young German neurologist across a small table in a theater in Hamburg, Germany. I'm here giving one-on-one talks called The Unenhanced, What Has Happened to Those Deemed Unfit, unquote, about my research on Axiom T4, the Nazi euthanasia program to exterminate the disabled. I'm afraid of what you're going to tell me, the neurologist says. I'm not surprised. I've heard similar things before. But this time is different. The young man sitting across from me is a doctor. Axiom T4 could not have happened without the willing participation of German doctors. I have a personal stake in making sure this story is remembered. In 1960, I was born missing bones in both legs. At the time, some thought I should not be allowed to live. Thankfully, my parents were not among them. I first discovered that people with disabilities were sterilized and killed by the Nazis when I was a teenager watching the TV miniseries Holocaust in 1978. But it would be years before I understood the connections between the killing of the disabled and the killing of Jews and other undesirables, all of whom were, in one way or another, deemed unfit. The neurologist does not know much about what I'm telling him. While he does know that approximately 300,000 disabled people were killed in T4 and its aftermath, he doesn't know about the direct connection between T4 and the Holocaust. He doesn't know that it was at Brandenburg, the first T4 site where methods of mass killing were tested, that the first victims of Nazi mass killings were the disabled, and that its personnel went on to establish and run the Nazi extermination camps at Treblinka, Belzec, and Sobibor. 3 years earlier, when I first arrived in Germany, I was consistently confronted with the treatment of those with disabilities under the Third Reich. But I soon realized I had to go back even further. In the 1920s, the disabled were mistreated, sterilized, experimented on, and killed in some German psychiatric institutions. In 1920, the psychiatrist Alfred Hoch and the jurist Carl Binding published their treatise Permitting the Destruction of Unworthy Life, unquote, which became the blueprint for the extermination of the disabled carried out by the Third Reich. In Dr. Edward Meltzer's 1923 survey of the parents of the disabled children in his care, they were asked, "Would you agree definitely to a painless shortcut of your child's life after it is determined by experts that it is incurably stupid?" Unquote. The results, which surprised Meltzer, were published in 1925. 73% responded that they were willing to have their children killed if they weren't told about it. I am also Jewish. At the Karl Bonhoeffer Psychiatric Hospital in the Berlin suburb of Wittenau were the exhibition A Double Stigma, The Fate of Jewish Psychiatric Patients was held. I learned about, as the exhibition title suggests, how Jewish patients were doubly stigmatized by being separated from other patients, denied pastoral care, and were cared for not at the expense of the Reich, but by Jewish organizations. Jewish patients were singled out for early extermination. By December of 1942, the destruction of the Jewish patient population at Wittenau was complete. The young neurologist in Hamburg did not know this history. It is only at the end of my talk with the neurologist that I notice he wears a hearing aid. I want to ask if he knows about 100%, the film produced by deaf Germans to show that they could assimilate and be productive citizens who worked. Did he know the hereditary deaf was singled out not only by the German authorities, but also by those with acquired deafness who tried to save themselves? Too often, even those of us with disabilities, do not know our own history. Not many people know about disability history in the U.S. either. They do not know that in the U.S. in 1927, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote that three generations of imbeciles are enough, as part of his opinion in Buck versus Bell, in which the Supreme Court ruled that compulsory sterilization of the unfit, unquote, was constitutional. This decision has never been expressly overturned. Many Americans still do not know about the so-called ugly laws, which in many states beginning in the late 1860s deemed it illegal for persons who were unsightly or unseemly, unquote, to even appear in public. The last of these laws was not repealed until 1974. Why is it important to know this history? We often say that what happened in Nazi Germany could not happen here. But some of it, like the mistreatment and sterilization of the disabled, did happen here. A reading of Hoke and Binding's Permitting the Destruction of Unworthy Life, unquote, shows the similarity between what they said and what exponents of practical ethics such as Peter Singer say about the disabled today. As recently as 2015, Singer, talking with the radio host Aaron Klein on his show, said, "I don't want my health insurance premiums to be higher so that infants who can experience zero quality of life can have expensive treatments," unquote. By the way, Peter Singer is a faculty member at Princeton University. These philosophers talk about the drain on resources, unquote, caused by lives lived with a disability, which eerily echoes what Hoke and Binding wrote about the financial and moral burden, quote, on a person's family, hospital, and state, unquote, caused by what they deem lives unworthy of living, unquote. Experts point out that the recent Republican health care proposals would strip Medicaid funding that helps the elderly, the poor, and the disabled live healthier and more dignified lives. A recent New York Times article quoted the Reverend Susan Flanders, a retired Episcopal priest, as saying, quote, "What we're paying for is something that many people wouldn't want if they had a choice. It's hundreds of dollars each day that could go towards their grandchildren's education or care for the people who could get well," unquote. In the article, Flanders, whose father had Alzheimer's, is described as, quote, "utterly unafraid to mix money into the conversation about the meaning of life when the mind deteriorates," unquote. Practical ethicists are similarly unafraid to do this, as were the Nazis. Third Reich school textbooks included arithmetic problems on how much it would cost to care for a person with a disability for a lifetime. 3 years ago, I was the only visitor at a museum dedicated to the history of the Rhein-Neckendorf area of Berlin. The museum building was once part of Wiesengrund, Wiesengrund, which in 1941 housed the wards for expert care of the municipal hospital for children. Down the hall with fluorescent lighting is a white-walled room with 30 wooden cribs. On each of the cribs was a history of a child, some as young as a few months old. This was the room in which these infants and children were experimented on and killed. The 30-bed Ward 3, the Ward for Expert Care, unquote, at Wiesengrund. My heart raced, my breath shortened. I could not stay in that room for long. The room evoked the first 4 weeks of my own life spent in an incubator. Nobody knew if I would live or die. What kind of society do we want to be? Those of us who live with disabilities are at the forefront of the larger discussion of what constitutes a valued life. What is a life worth living? Too often, the lives of those of us who live with disabilities are not valued, and they are feared. At the root of this fear is misunderstanding, misrepresentation, and a lack of knowledge of disability history and thus disabled lives. I think that the writer here has made clear, I think, the continuity both between eugenics thinking in the U.S. and elsewhere, and in Germany pre-Hitler, and how that influenced first the Aktion T4, the euthanasia program, which in turn begat, using biblical language very directly, the Nazi extermination programs. I've talked about this in numerous shows, Miscellaneous Archive Show N12, most recently, I think, in For the Record, it might have been 908, maybe 909. I will have the precise reference in the description for the show in our discussions with Wesley Smith, we have spoken about this. And there are other Miscellaneous Archive shows as well. For the Record, 664 goes into this as well. A couple of good books, The Nazi Connection by Stefan Kuhl, K-U-U-M-L-H-L, and also Edwin Black's The War Against the Weak go into this.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
With the Republican Party slashing the social safety net and at the same time gutting regulatory agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency and taking a hands-off approach to agencies like the FDA and permitting basically polluters to pollute at will, and the manufacturers of unsafe foods and or pharmaceuticals to market their products, we are living in a society that is basically being inundated with mutagens, ultimately the carcinogens that make their way into people's bodies through a gutted EPA or a gutted FDA, or the deleterious effects of taking food or drugs that are not safe and would otherwise have been regulated, are going to produce a wave of illness, cancers, other degenerative diseases, and beyond that, allowing mutagens into the environment is ultimately going to lead to a significant increase in birth defects. And when you get a society that is economically deceived, in which the less advantaged economic families are faced with the cost of sustaining a child born with a serious birth disability, the temptation to want to have them eliminated is going to be significant. Ultimately, I think that with our society being inundated with carcinogens, mutagens, and unsafe products, the health system itself is going to be overwhelmed, the healthcare system itself. And I think the future, sadly, of healthcare in the U.S., for people that do not have a lot of money, is physician-assisted suicide. Pay close attention to the austerity being advocated by the Republican Party and with the Right to Die movement, and do note the continuity here between Nazi eugenics and euthanasia as espoused by people like James Mason and what we are seeing here. There will be many links going into some of these topics at greater length. This concludes For the Record Program 995, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates, being recorded on February 6th of the year 2018. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.